Here is the first ever interview I did, and I dared to record it. I'm so happy that Otto von Busch was my first interview partner, because I admire his writings about fashion. I prepared a lot of questions in advance, but we turned out to have a talk which moved away from most of what I had put together. It was quite a ride, touching topics like the dark side of fashion, bullying, social control, but also fashion as a means to connect, the romanticization of handcrafts, injustice, and why don't we dare more in everyday fashion. So before we start now, I want to give a shout out to these episode's sponsors. First is the girl who sat in front of me in the metro today, and she had a shirt which said, "Do your thing." And she was 5 or 6, so her mother was maybe involved in choosing that shirt, but it had shiny pearls, so I'm sure she also decided to wear that. And it made me smile because I felt like that's the only age where you can wear such a shirt. The other shout out I want to give to the man who stopped the car to let me cross the street, because on my side was a person I didn't want to meet in the middle of the night. My name is Johanna, last name Schwab. I will be living in New York City for the next 6 months. As a lover of fashion and its invisible power, of words, voices, and questioning, I had the idea to start a podcast. You will be getting a mix here. I'll put my soliloquies on record and do what I like the most. Talk to people whose work and thoughts I find inspiring. This podcast is called Refashion New York City. Hello, Otto. For my first interview, I am talking to Otto von Busch, one of the most original designers, thinkers, and idea givers in fashion. That's what I think. I'm beyond glad to sit in front of you now, because I planned on this for years. But like, I described you, but how would you describe your role in fashion yourself?
Thank you first. Thank you very much. I'm an educator, for sure. You know, I love teaching and school and what's going on within the sort of the university. I do work with sort of arts too, and I have a sort of artistic approach, and I did my PhD in Gothenburg on sort of within the field that was called artistic research. So it was an idea of sort of merging a sort of an academic practice with artistic practice. And I still sort of really put myself in that realm, but within fashion. So that's what I'm doing.
That's great. But like, how would you describe the part which is artistic?
Some of my work, I mean, more and more of my work has been about writing. So when I started out, it was much more workshop-based. It was much more practical and so much about participation, getting DIY perspectives, sort of do-it-yourself perspectives into fashion, trying to understand how what we then called new media, but this idea is a participation, co-design, co-authorship, things that were really taking off and becoming now everyday sort of digital media. And how could that be sort of applied to fashion? How could we sort of hack into the operating system of fashion and make it more participatory, more like Linux or whatever, you know? So I used a lot of those kind of technical metaphors in the beginning. And I worked really on engaging people in taking ownership of their own garments. And so that was really the emphasis on how do we think of fashion and the role of the designer much more as an educator, facilitator, and in a sense, I know, almost coach, therapist, if you want to say so, and to help people put their own authorship into their clothing more than buying ready-made things, in a sense, and sort of aligning with already ready-made, sort of pre-packaged identities, in a sense. So it was a lot about sort of reclaiming the sewing machine and these kind of things, and that was very intense. And I think it's just, you know, what just happened over the years. First of all, perhaps I felt a little frustration from that position, because I felt a lot of it turned into becoming, or that those kind of similar strategies became sort of viral marketing, and that was sort of co-opted in a sense a lot. And I've also felt like I had a very big emphasis on practical skills in the beginning, and I felt I missed out on the sort of the mythology of fashion, or that fashion is also a little bit mystical, a little bit psychological too, of course, but also that there's a spectacle around fashion that the DIY practice often misses, and I wanted to understand more of that. And really, much of my work came out of an experiences of being bullied for my clothes in school, you know. But also at the same time, that what saved me in a sense was that I could make my own clothes. I could sew things that disconnected me a bit from the victimhood of being judged by these cool kids for what I wore. So when I made this camouflage anorak and I added my patches and I did these kind of things that nobody else really could, and I felt so empowered by that. At the same time, I felt perhaps after also a few years after my thesis and so on, that I never really put a finger on what was the problem in the first case. I never really put a finger on what made those cool kids feel that they could judge me and they could actually take this position of the cool kids using their clothing to marginalize me, and how did they do it so effectively? And I felt the frustration that I hadn't actually been looking at the problem too much. I had been so constructive and so affirmative in my work, which I still support, and I think one should be, but I also felt like I hadn't really looked at the sort of the darker side of what clothing does. So that's why over my last years, I've been doing much less practical hands-on workshops. I've actually been, unfortunately, working much less with, you know, with these workshops and sewing together with people. And it's been much more about writing and reading and trying to understand, you know, everything from the dynamics of bullying and violence in clothing and how that expresses itself, to a sort of also understanding what is sort of, we can call it sort of almost a mystical power in fashion, that what is it that affects us so deeply with clothing? You know, I think in my earlier work, it was much more about just organizing people coming together and sewing things together, and the sort of real excitement that life with others around the sewing machine brings. And I think now it's just been years of much more introspection, I would say, and more. Perhaps, you know, I don't want to say critical analysis, but really turning inwards and trying to sort of unpack really what is the power of fashion? Why do we care? Why has it been blamed for being shallow while we all know that it just hurts us so bad when someone says something about our clothing, you know? So really just, you know, I just tried to say, oh, I need to unpack that. I need to better understand that, because otherwise I felt the frustration that perhaps I treat fashion too shallowly too, in a sense, you know, by just being so affirmative and just loving to sew things together. You know, I just, you know, how do I know we address the right problem? How do I know better that also that we don't produce a new type of elitism? You're like, whoa, now we are the cool ones because we sewed these old clothes, and look at you poor guys, you know, whatever, love, you only bought your clothes, you know, so that it produces another type of elitism and another type of judgment, when I was really trying to sort of, you know, better understand, are those judgments perhaps even necessary in a sense? You know, is that really what clothing and fashion is, that it puts at that risk? You know, it's something about when I have this outfit on and I put it out there, I put myself out there in order to be judged. You know, I want you to see me. And if that is because I made this myself, or because I'm so happy I bought this cool thing or whatever, you know. But there's an interplay that I felt was interesting that I needed to understand better, that, you know, why do we risk ourselves? And why aren't we all comfortable in uniforms and just in jeans and a hoodie or something and just try to escape everything? You know, why is it that some people, in some instances, not every day, but in some instances at some nightclub, before that date, before that job interview or something, we do something daring because we want to manipulate, we want to affect the way that people see us, and we want to present a self that is just not that uniform self, you know, but just another type of self that is a little bit risky, or a little bit, you know, I am also interesting, or I have an interest, you know, I love this band, or I, you know, or I was in Thailand, I have no idea what it is, but perhaps my t-shirt just says something more than it's just white, you know, it just has this little connector to people, you know, and what is that connection? How do we better unpack that and understand what is the sort of the palette or quiver, if you want to say, of or the range of expressions and channels we have to communicate with in fashion, in this interface, this social interface that, that fashion is. Oh, that was a very long answer.
Yeah, but it's so great. You were talking about the bullying, like it's a bit ago, but is there something you would say to these people, not to embarrass them now, but to address the problem? You figured it out now? Or?
Well, I haven't figured it out. And of course it's, I mean, I cannot talk to them, you know. Yeah. I was very lucky, you know, in the sense that, you know, my stepfather had been bullied. So, you know, when I came home, he just rushed to the phone and started calling all these kids, you know, and all the parents of these kids, you know, he just exploded, you know. And of course, I'm so thankful for that response in a sense, you know, because that was a very direct response. And I felt like, wow, that is how one should approach these things. And also, I mean, this bullying dynamics is so fascinating, you know, because, of, you know, now when I look back at it, you know, it wasn't the coolest kids that did it, you know, they were... You know, they had sort of outsourced it to the next coolest kids and the kids that I was, you know, I knew I could never be part of the really cool sporty foot soccer, whatever, you know, but they actually had sort of outsourced it in a smart way to the people that I would be connecting to, the people that could have been my friends that were turned the ones that turned against me, you know. So I think, you know, the dynamics of bullying is just endlessly fascinating. And I think it's just that most of us perhaps do have sort of experiences of it of various kinds. I've been doing this project that I've been calling the Fashion Police, which is just this kind of play with it. Like, you know, when we talk about why do we follow fashion, it's not that, you know, fashion designers or Anna Wintour or someone is out there sort of punishing us. You know, it's our peers that control us. It's the small comments, the side looks, extremely subtle signals that we experience in everyday life, you know, or even this kind of inverted signals, you know, in the school cafeteria, the cool kids will say like, "A nice shoes, Otto," or something, which of course means they're not nice at all. But it actually means don't come and sit with us, you know. They use clothing as an excuse to say something about social positioning in general, you know, but clothing is this excuse by which we can judge and position and comment on each other and gossip about each other. And I think what the Fashion Police project was about was just getting my students to write down these kind of witness statements, I call them, you know. So I made a little form from this Fashion Police that they could sort of report in if they had been a police abuse, you know. So the Fashion Police are these undercover agents that are out there, which are our peers, you know. And people wrote down different stories about, you know, someone said something or someone la la. Just when I've been trying it on different classes, and it's everything from fashion classes to like illustration or whatever, I've been doing guest lectures and things. The fascinating part has perhaps been that it felt like at art school, the fine art students and those, they had very rich stories of these kind of situations, you know. Whereas the fashion students didn't have so many, or somehow, you know, it were very sort of shallow, very not, you know, not so dramatic, perhaps, you know. And it just felt like, well, perhaps that is a bit it too, because perhaps you come to fashion school if you just have positive experiences of fashion. If you haven't been bullied, you know, if you haven't been traumatized by it, then you want to do fashion, you know. Whereas if you have been traumatized, I mean, by it, perhaps you have been marginalized, perhaps you've been the bullied kid that turned into starting drawing and felt withdrawn from the rest of the class and all the cool kids, and that turned you into fine art. I mean, then of course I cannot draw, you know, parallels around all of this, but it really felt like, wow, there's a dynamic here that is fascinating in the art school where the, you know, the cool, the winners of the social game are doing fashion. And it's not, you know, the students that have been much more introvert and dark and gothic, whatever, are the ones who end up doing fine arts in a way, perhaps the process also. I mean, now I don't want to psychoanalysis on this, but, and to me, it's just fascinating because I think we treat, in general, fashion schools don't understand what we're doing. We have no language to unpack the trauma that people are bringing in with their clothing, you know? So that's really where I want to try to get a discussion or a discourse, you know, going within fashion schools. Was it really the power that we wield? You know, we send out all these fashion designers out there to design all these things, but do they know they make weapons? You know, do they know that they're actually part of something that is, you know, we know that, you know, yes, don't outsource, don't send things to factories that are collapsing, don't do, you know, polluted or, you know, do more eco-cotton or whatever you like, you know. But how do we actually deal with the damages that our own practices psychologically are part in producing? Because it's not the fault of fashion. But, you know, the fashion industry survives on a very controversial relationship to our customers, you know, that, you know, if I buy a toaster or perhaps even a car, you know, but there's a functional emphasis on it. You know, I may not buy a new toaster until it breaks. You know, a lot of industrial design and other kind of design fields are, you know, there's a certain kind of functionality, even if there's like disposability in this. But fashion designers, it's taken for granted that you should have a new customer coming back every season or as often as possible, you know, which means that, you know, as a fashion designer, I need to, as much as I boost your confidence in these new clothes, I also need to make sure that you come back, you know, so there's something inherent in the industry that I need to undermine your self-esteem also enough that you come back to me, you know. So fashion design is really about producing addiction, in a sense. You know, it's really about boosting you temporarily, but not enough so that you're happy forever, because then you wouldn't come back, you know. So there's a sort of an interesting addiction dynamic, in the sense that we are really dependent. The fashion business is dependent on customers coming back, feeling bad about themselves enough that they need a new boost. They need a new ego boost by buying these new clothes. And this ego boost is often going to come not necessarily at the cost of someone else, but if I feel much better about myself, I can also have the possibility of looking down on others, you know, so, I got these new cool sneakers from this latest drop that I've queued up for, et cetera, et cetera. And my sneakers are better than your sneakers because you got your sneakers that is a cheap copy on Amazon or something like that, you know. So there's a certain kind of dynamic, too, about, you know, that I buy myself the privilege or the possibility of just looking down on certain others that buy the copy or just as not as cool as whatever, you know. So there is definitely a certain hierarchical social game going on in which fashion plays out. So just to come back, you know, how does this affect design? Why does it have to do with design? And I think, to me, I mean, we will not solve this by making some sort of non-violent products, you know. That's not what we're, you know. But really, could we think about other ways of being a fashion designer then that deals with this aspect of clothing? That could I, you know, rather than undermining people's self-esteem enough for them to come, you know, could they actually, how would it be if a fashion designer was more like a therapist or much more, you know, I have no idea, am I still buying clothes to deal with my own bullying from 30 years back? You know, I don't know. Perhaps I should have a clothing shrink, a fashion shrink that I should talk to about this, you know. Perhaps, how would that be? What would that relationship be? And how would that, you know, rather than spending the money on clothing that is then cheaply produced overseas and there's all this kind of chain of abuses that happens, you know, could I, just like perhaps I would go and see a psychologist or a psychologist, you know, to try to talk to me, could we sew clothes together then? And that would be a way to sort of help me reclaim a certain kind of authorship and self-knowledge or whatever it is. So my interest is exactly that, you know, these kind of DIY practices that I explored earlier from a much more, I was fascinated by just the social aspect of it, of doing it together, and just the pleasure of doing things together with others. I think I'm just now trying to really probe into, could this change, could this offer certain kind of places in the industry that is much more, deal with psychological issues, deal with much more sort of, deeper in a sense of the questions of self-esteem, questions of self-knowledge, questions of who am I, in a sense, you know. Ah, that was a bit long answer
again.
No,
I love it. Like, it goes so many directions and it leads me away from my questions, which I like. It's totally fine. But I was wondering, because yesterday I read an article and it was mentioned Lou Dallas got a, you know, Lou Dallas, she's a upcycling fashion designer.
Okay.
And she's nominated for the Fashion Fund of Vogue and CFDA. And it said, like, we want to state that there's something very special about the nominees this season, because they are also focusing on handcrafts. And I feel like, what do you think about that? Like, Vogue pretending that it's very special to do a handcraft in fashion. I was a bit irritated by that.
Of course, there have always been, you know, embellishments, etc., you know. And of course, these, I mean, certain machines and techniques are getting better, but, you know, a lot of hand embellishment, you know, and sequins and things were, you know, hand attached for a long, long time. So, yes, and of course, all clothes, no clothes are fully automated. You know, there's handcraft in every sort of product. Right, okay, right.
Thank you for telling me, because I was...
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's more about the sort of the romance. There's a certain kind of romanticization around crafts. And who are the hands that will actually do this? I think it's just my question in the end. It's like, yes, when you pay for haute couture, yes, there is like women in these haute couture houses that do a lot of that hand stitching, enormously costly hours. Some are more costly because they live in Paris or something like that, you know. Often, of course, they're sent overseas to do this, basically the same kind of work with slightly, we don't need to discuss the quality of it because it's not necessarily less quality, but less paid for sure, you know. So I'm always just a little scared when it comes to the questions around craft, because it's really like, what hands are going to do this?
Yeah.
Whose hands? Who can afford it? Just because I buy it and it looks more handcrafted, will I pay more respect to that or something? Will I? Will I not? No, perhaps not. I mean, I don't know. It's like, I think there's a sense, we often respond to things that have a little bit of hand inaccuracies or whatever you want to call it, you know. We romanticize that a bit and we think that people are going to care more somehow about it. And especially if it is done by hands that are close to us, if it's my grandmother or something, or if it's white hands because it's done in Sweden or something. And I then sort of care less if it's done by colored hands that are done in Africa or in a factory in China or something, you know. So suddenly the same kind of handwork is just ignored when it's overseas or far away and super cherished when it's within the family or something. And that is, of course, certainly, I mean, we just need to be more aware that what we put into these aspects of craft and exactly this romanticization of craft, we just need to be careful how we judge what those craft elements are. And also this, that 20, 30 years ago, you still saved money sewing things yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, craft, I mean, no, I made my own pants to save money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody makes their own pants today to save money because it's cheaper buying the ready-made pants than buying the fabric, you know. So suddenly craft and so DIY practice is not something that is something that comes out of poverty. You know, if you see kids in pre-K or whatever in school wearing homemade clothes, I mean, exactly a generation ago that was poor. Now it means that, you know, someone in the family has time enough to sit and sew these clothes, and that means that the most probably persons of privilege rather than the ones buying, you know, it's the same with coming with home-baked goods, like the one who have the time to bake home. It's not the little family that works 3-4 jobs who have to buy these ready-made pre-packaged cheap cookies, you know. There's all these kind of things. A lot of our imagination around craft has just been totally sort of inverted over the last decade or decades. I mean, with globalization. So I think we're still sort of often stuck in sort of dreaming craft as something authentic and these kind of things, and perhaps something that could address poverty rather than is actually a sign of privilege. Often it's a sign of, and also.
But I loved it because I was such a big fan of her work, and then it, like, when I read this yesterday, I felt like there's something strange. So thank you for talking about this.
Yeah, well, I think it's the same. It's the same thing comes to repair, which is something that I think is really important, and of course it's around everything from sustainability to really this just hands-on engagement with our clothes rather than throwing things out.
Yeah.
Repair has this sort of a sense of commitment, there's a sense of just coming closer to materials and our living world that we care. You know, there's a possibility of care. So I'm a big fan of repair. I'm a big fan of both explicit repairs, where you show that, this is repaired, and it's like leaves a sign, and it's like, I'm proud of this repair, you know. I mean, actually exaggerate the stitches in order to make a cool statement or something like that, or whatever, you know, something. At the same time, of course, you know, certain garments you may need to exactly invisible repair in order to sort of, you know, because you don't want to have that cigarette burn at that place or whatever it is, you know. At the same time, I think we just need to be aware of, also they're coming back to the class issue around that, you know, who is allowed and who is strong enough socially, esteem-wise, hierarchy-wise, to wear a repaired garment. You know, yes, it works in an art school. Way, hooray, you know, we can all agree on that. But, you know, if the CEO of this company or someone working in a much more precarious situation come in a company, you know, I just got my new job at this bank, but I'm not really rich enough like all the other cool bankers around, and I'm coming there in my first suit, and I feel I really want to prove myself because my background is not from this established social class, you know. Of course, it would be much, much harder for me to come there in a repaired suit that has some sort of, whoa, look at me, I'm repaired, you know, I can't, you know. So it's just, we just need to be really careful about that. It's easy to sit at an art school, it's easy to sit within a certain kind of position of privilege and cherish visible mending and repairs, you know. But of course, exactly, if you come from poor clothes, you know, you definitely do not want to come in repaired clothes. You definitely do not want to make that statement. So we just need to be much more careful and aware. And you know, I can come back to that to my own practice that, you know, it's easy for me to run these DIY workshops and think, because we're, you know, and run it basically with mainly fashion students, because of course they all used to have a little sort of, oh, I want to make a statement with my clothes. It's cool to wear something a little bit homemade, looking a little bit wild. But, you know, many of my friends that are having very traditional jobs or being, you know, a doctor or a teacher or something like that, they don't want to make those kind of statements, you know, that's not on their radar not that they're less, of course they may be less creative because they just don't have a venue to enact their own creativity, but they definitely don't want to dare that social game in that sense. And I think we just need to be really aware, and that comes back to my own practice in the sense of who are these DIY people that are actually going to take control of their garments and live this free life with their clothes and these kind of things. Well, you know, yes, working with fashion students, that comes fairly natural, but we need to emphasize it slightly different or practice differently and find more perhaps safe environments if I'm going to start getting my high school teacher friends or like working in, you know, jobs within certain, you know, ministries or bureaucracies and things. If they're going to come in these garments, you know, they need to practice a bit. You know, they need to, you know, feel much safer in garments than the sort of the daringness that I basically took for granted. You know, just wearing colored socks is a big step for them, you know, or like changing the shoelaces into neon or something, you know, that so we just need to sort of really see what are the levels here we want or we expect participation to happen in, and don't take everything for granted that everybody has this inert need to just come out there and just be totally wild in their garments.
But that's also, like, do you sometimes get bored that fashion is so much about appropriateness? Like, does it sometimes bore you that this world is like this, that as a bank you have to look like this, and da-da-da?
I must say that. Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm more scared, if you want to say so, being in an art school where I see very few students who wear garments they made themselves.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm often surprised how few students that really walk around in wild outfits. And we're still in New York, you know, we're still in a place where that is really appreciated. I mean, I can understand it in Sweden, which is a little bit more, you know, it's conforming, it's a little bit less, it shows less appreciation for that socially. Whereas a lot of people here give great comment. If you come in wild outfits, this is just another social dynamic. Americans talk too. It's a very rewarding social environment to dress playfully, I really feel. And I'm just, you know, exactly concerned that too few, perhaps, of my students explore that possibility and really realize what a fantastic arena, theater, scene, if you want to say so, the street landscape of New York is, to just try out and dare to play a game of fashion and appearances that is much more exciting than perhaps what they would feel in their hometowns or something like that, you know. So I really try to encourage my students to try more of that. Just also because, you know, if you haven't felt it yourself, it's really hard. Like, there's something about the immediacy of feedback with clothing and fashion that is so rewarding. You know, if I want to design a chair or something, you know, it takes me a long, long time. Yeah. Chairs are, it's a mess, you know, and then I sit down on it. Or I have a friend, or whatever, you know, and then I have a few friends sitting on it. And after a long time, and, you know, and give some feedback or something. The clothing is, of course, it can take extreme long time. You know, certain garments are extremely complex. But if I want to do, I can combine a weird outfit really, I mean, within a few hours and then go out to this nightclub or wherever it is and just try it out and just feel what the response is and hear the response and just, you know, so there's something of that immediacy with clothing and fashion that is also so experiential. It's mm-hmm. so much felt in the body and in our attention and our, I mean, overall cognition that it's just trying to sort of get my students to experience the richness of clothing in that kind of rewarding and or also unrewarding. Mm. It can also be, you know, or just trying to get them to sort of dare that a bit more so they don't necessarily just end up. I mean, some rich student end up in all Chanel or really mm-hmm. safe from extremely expensive clothing, whereas mm-hmm. some poorer students are play safe, but within an H&M or whatever, Forever 21 scene. So it's more like, you know, how do you come? What can you? How do you take ownership and to try things out and risk a bit to feel what clothing can do mm-hmm. for you? Because I feel like if you haven't tried it out, really, how can you be a designer that is going to do things for others, you know? Of course, I mean, often a fashion school is like, oh, how can you be a designer if you don't know pattern cutting and you don't know these kind of things, you know? But it's also, well, how can you be a fashion designer if you haven't experienced the pleasures and pain of clothing in that sense, you know? And I feel exactly, New York is such a rich ecology of trying that out that you perhaps will not experience in, you know, Vienna or wherever, no, you know? So really, not. Like, how do students that come here really be part of that scene.
Yeah, but do you think it has to do, like, when I was younger, I didn't tell it before, but I wanted to be a fashion designer too, but I wasn't patient enough for the sewing machine. And I was always wondering that if you're a fashion designer, you have to imagine another woman or, like, someone else wearing your stuff. You know, it's not you, it's, like, somewhere else. Like, it's this visionary thing you're creating. It's this one thing, but also it's so, like we were talking about the bullying before, it's so personal to wear your own stuff. Like, what do you think, like, what's the problem for your students?
Yeah, I mean, so often what is a comment coming from students graduating when they start working, a comment that often comes back is that, well, fashion school is all egocentric, mm-hmm. you know, you all so do collections. Yeah, I mean, it's basically it's art too, mm-hmm. right, exactly. And then suddenly you have to realize, oh my God, there's a market. Oh my God, there's a user. Someone's going to buy this, you know. And that is the big shock for many students, which is kind of ironic too, because, you know, within a lot of interaction design and even industrial design or whatever, you know, there's always a user, you know, always have to sort of, you know, whereas certain fine arts and fashion is just totally egocentric. But at the same time, there is for sure, you know, some sort of, you know, just understanding that there's people out there, there's people out there that is not you. You know, that's the basics of it, right? Right. I mean, there's also this kind of classic comment that, you know, if you work in design, if someone critiques your work, you know, if someone says, like, I don't like it, whatever, you know, then in design, you go back and say, like, well, what did I do wrong? You know, you ask, you try to understand, you try to make it better. Mm-hmm. You know, you try to sort of understand what this critique comes from and why people would not buy it. In this sense, you know. Whereas I think in fine arts, in the sense of a sort of artistic practice is much more like, if you don't like my work, well, you just don't understand it. It's like because, you know, it's sort of taken for granted that it is all about self-expression. It's all about the artist's mind, in a sense, and people should be thankful for getting access to it. Of course, there's a parody, in a sense, but still, it's I think there's often schools grow that mentality within them, in a sense, that, you know, the way that fashion school and fashion critiques and things are framed and things, it's like, find your inner authenticity, be authentic to yourself. There's a lot of sort of self-referential language. A lot of the research you're doing is definitely not focus groups. You're not asking people what their opinions are. You know, your research is much more visual research. Oh, I'm interested in elephants and banana. I have nobody, you know, you know, to create an image that you believe in, and then you're going to transmit your belief in this vision strong enough to convince your jury, in a sense, rather than get it sold to the few people, you know. So, that was a long.
Okay, no, I love it. Like, I will have a look in my book. If Oh, of course, I guess. Okay, nice. When I read your texts, I like it so much because they always lead me somewhere next. And I think also I felt it's about writing as a method, to show writing as a method too. I'm a big, like, for the short version, fan of Hannah Arendt, and says she writes to understand. So I want to know, what is your drive in writing, and what is your drive in writing about fashion?
Yeah, well, I mean, I always feel like frustrated that I'm not a better academic writer, you know, because I always like...
I love to read it like that.
No, but it totally meanders everywhere. I mean, it's like these answers, just, woo, you know, I can never stay on topic, you know, and a classic sort of comment on academic writing is like, you know, just make one point, that's enough, you know, just stay to one point, you know, and I was like, there's too many things I want to say in everything. So that's always a tricky balance to keep. So, I mean, it took me a long time to feel comfortable about my writing. And it's really, to me, it's really a sort of a journey, sort of, you know, that I take on my writing. It's really sort of a train of thought. I'm very bad at really knowing what I want to say, you know, and sort of keep exactly in that, you know, and start somewhere and really end with a conclusion and make the statement really strong. I'm just not really, perhaps I will be better. Oh, I don't know if it's really my cup of tea.
Just for like, it's short, I like it because it's, it leaves place to think. I like that.
Like yeah.
Path, you know?
Right, right. And I feel a bit like, I mean, I feel it, my you know, as I write, I feel I'm much more interested in circling topics than sort of making, this is the essence of the topic. You know, I feel it, I really love to try to see things from many perspectives as possible, in a sense, almost. So that's why that's really how my mind perhaps also works, in a sense, that it really tries to sort of orbit, if you want to say, a topic, and tries to sort of look at it from many different perspectives, which also means that there's a certain, I often end up in paradoxes or, like, you know, contradictions almost, that... it's funny, I spent so much time when I was young, playing role-playing games, like Dungeons and Dragons and these kind of things, you know. And that was a very strong community of friends that we played every day, basically, for many, many, many years, from exactly teens and up. And I often feel that there's something a little bit similar to how I write. It's like a sort of a storytelling. It's a little bit of an adventure that I want to take the reader on this little adventure. And it's not necessarily me. You know, I really enjoy writing under different voices and different, like, what if we take this stance and then we are becoming this other person and we try to look at fashion from the perspective of the bully, for example, you know, or from the perspective of this elitist or from this perspective of someone that is really, you know, who is nasty or something and wants to use clothing from that, you know. So I really like that sort of struggle with many voices and many positions because I also feel that we are just not one, too. You know, I think we are many different persons. You know, when I am with my, you know, parents, I am one type of person. When I am with my old friend, I mean, it becomes very obvious when we moved abroad, you know, and I visit, I still have a lot of contact with my old friends, that role-playing friends. You know, we meet every summer, you know. But of course, I am becoming also that old Otto when we meet. And that is a slightly different Otto than I am here as the teacher, or than I am as a father, or a husband, or even at a conference versus in a workshop, or etc. It's really how many different positions, and really how clothing also takes a part in that, which I think is so fascinating, and it's something I'm also now trying to sort of get more aware of, and perhaps also articulate better to myself. You know, I dress much less adventurous when I'm back in Sweden. You know, when we came here first, and, you know, we lived here for almost 2 years, and I thought, whoa, and I got and made things and got things. I thought, oh, this works really well in New York, you know, and I came back with that wardrobe to Sweden. It's like, I just, and even in Gothenburg, it's a fairly big city, you know, and I felt, I cannot wear this on the streets in Gothenburg. This is not going to work, you know. So, you know, it's funny. I feel like New York really does something to my sort of dressed practice in that. But it's also fascinating because then, you know, I had this patched up jacket with all these patches and things. And, you know, and then I Skyped with an old friend from Sweden just the other day. or I mean, this was a few months ago now, but it became very obvious at this moment, because I was sitting in this outfit that works perfect in New York, and it wasn't even some sort of extravagant mm-hmm. thing. And then my friend, and we were just chatting, and we're, you know, friends for almost 30 years. And then he was just, you know, we would chat, la, 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 and then I was moving the camera around. He was like, oh, what are you wearing? You know?
Yeah.
And he was saying it in a tone
yeah.
that was just very obvious that, of course, he was curious, what am I wearing? Mm-hmm. But it was also this, what are you wearing? In a way that just marked that is not something that we are wearing, you know? And I was something, wow, what is he doing to me? Why do I actually now have to explain in a defensive way what I'm wearing here in New York to my oldest, one of my closest friends, in a way that I was almost excusing myself for what I'm wearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, wow, what is this? You know, how is it that it's actually perhaps our closest friends, in a sense, that control us the most, and where we feel, not necessarily that I was feeling, you know, shame or whatever, you know, something, but I just thought, why do I have to explain? And why, how did that comment just affect me so, or our social mm-hmm. relationship in such a way? And so, whatever, you know, so those kind of things, I'm really fascinated by, you know, what is it that affects our clothing and who we are then, you know, mm-hmm. because of course he knows me from that position that we have had for so many years, but actually also he doesn't know me as the teacher who teaches at the fashion program, mm-hmm. who tries to enact a certain kind of encouragement among my students that, yes, dress up, just play with your clothing. And I want to be a teacher that almost encourages that. You know, oh, whatever, it's just mm-hmm. so fascinating. And really how we are many different people, how we in different relationships, the outfit that I'm wearing here, is that really what I want my kids' friends to see me drop off my kids or pick up my kids at school in? Or will it actually affect
mm-hmm.
them?
Yeah.
And does it affect them in a good or bad way? You know, because mm-hmm. perhaps, you know, my older daughter would say like, well, my father's a fashion teacher, mm-hmm. and the other cool kids would be like, wow, you know? Whereas perhaps the younger one, they don't really know what that is. So they would mm-hmm. just think like, well, you know, his father is some weirdo. No, but, you know, mm-hmm. it's just fascinating because I just feel like suddenly there's so many more other kind of calculations about who we are, mm-hmm. or who we tell ourselves we are, who we dress to think we are. And now it sounds like I dress in sort of totally, I don't know. So, yeah. It's not some sort of masquerade. It's not some sort of, you know, wild outfit. It's
yeah.
just these kind of small things, you know, leather pants, not leather pants, you know, what references do these, you know, black metal t-shirt or not
mm.
black metal t-shirt, you know, should it be a devil on, you know, should, how, you know, it's not some sort of, you know, extravagant symbolism or, you know, capes and masks and stuff,
yeah.
you know, it's not something like that.
Yeah,
it's really like, it's just like, you know, whatever, you know, and it's so fascinating just feeling how, trying to be a bit more aware of actually how that play goes on. And at the same time, it's like, well, of course, it would be so much easier if it was just in jeans and a hoodie. Like,
yeah.
why do I do this to myself? And of course,
you're right.
it's so obvious why we all instinctively retreat back into jeans and hoodie, because it's so much, you know,
mm-hmm.
if we actually get out there, there's so much more, you know, computation and calculation that has to happen in our brain just
mm-hmm.
to sort of deal with what's going to happen today, you know, who I'm going to see. Can I appear like this? But at the same time, that's not what I want to end up in. You know,
mm-hmm.
I really want to figure this out, like I want to put my own experience as the vehicle to understand these, you know, rather than having interviews with people, I want to feel it in my body myself. I want that either, you know, pleasure or pain, shame or, you know, whatever experiences that I'm feeling, to try to really better understand and put myself as the sensor, as the
yeah.
probe, to just sort of be better aware of what clothing does to us and how we feel it inside our bodies. So,
I really loved it, because when you talked, I had the sentence in mind, was like, be creative, but be it somewhere else. That's what I sometimes, and that's what's so challenging about fashion and of what I think is so interesting, that like as an artist, you can say, that's my artwork, you know, like you have this, there's this gap between me and the artwork, and it's like there, and it's, like, but when I wear like my paintings or stuff, it's like, it's so much more direct. But there's this thing of like creativity is so important, as everybody says. But when it comes to fashion and you show some creativity, it's always judged, you know, it's strange somehow.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I don't know if you can relate to this.
No, but exactly. And I think I was really, so that was, I made this decision quite early in my thesis, my sort of research work, where I did all these workshops and I did this, you know, this recyclopedia where I made these kind of cookbooks about how to change, you know, how to alter clothing. And I realized fairly quickly that if I was wearing those outfits as I was presenting my work, mm-hmm. people immediately judged the quality of the overall work mm-hmm. on how I looked. So I felt like I could actually never wear the outfits that I was doing when I was presenting my work, because that immediately sort of people started looking, oh, how has the seams done? Or mm-hmm. or like, oh, you look like something, blah, 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 you know. So mm-hmm. then they actually did not see, if I could talk about these workshops, I could talk about the politics of da, 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 whatever, you know, but they only looked at my clothes. You know? Yeah. So I really felt I cannot, yeah, yeah. you know, I need to present this in much more conservative outfits mm. and just not homemade, because they would immediately, you know, if the seams were bad, then they would disqualify the whole mm. approach in a sense, you know. So I felt, which is a tricky balance too when it comes to what is then sort of called artistic research and this kind of academic perspective on creative artistic practice or whatever it is, you know, where now I'm suddenly writing a thesis about your work, or I mean it's getting more and more common in a sense in PhDs in art, artistic practice
totally,
things.
Yeah.
Because I felt like there's something going on there too, that coming back to this question of like putting a work out there and distancing from it. So in a classic academic study is mm-hmm. like, oh, we look at this group, we look at this phenomenon out in society, and I am trying to disconnect myself slightly, at least as an artist. Of course, I'm always engaged, but you know, there's dists, you know, here is my work, but there's a much more closer connection still, that this is still my work. Mm. And I felt like what happened in those kind of two, when those two things were brought together, that an artist still doing their own work, but then also writing a thesis about their own work, the thesis became a defense of their own work. You know, mm-hmm. so it became almost a narrowing down mm-hmm. of what your work could be, because at least as an artist, you can drop it after a while.
Mm-hmm.
This is my work, yes, 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 but it's in the eyes of the beholder a bit, at least.
Yeah.
You know, you can at least throw it out there.
Yeah.
Right, right, or, you know, and you can sort of drop it with a sort of an artistic gesture, and we stand in the gallery and we look at things and we don't necessarily all identify it with you, in a sense. But what happens with this kind of artistic or academic thing is also that it felt like so much of artistic research became like trying to sort of patch up academically your mm-hmm. academic practice in order to sort of make it more bulletproof against mm-hmm. different kind of artistic attacks, you know, or academic attacks. It's like, how have you thought about, you know, a feminist perspective or post-colonial perspective or whatever, or different kind of, you know, possible critiques against your artwork. And what you had to do as an artistic researcher is like hold all these fronts up and, you know, patch,
yeah.
oh my God, you know, don't attack me on that, you know, la, la, you know. And it felt like, wow, this is
yeah.
a very weird way of doing, why are we doing this to ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think also that's where part of this idea of like being many persons, taking other voices became
mm-hmm.
a way for me to sort of try to escape that perspective. That no, I, you know, it's not my job to defend DIY practice, to defend
mm.
all these things that I'm doing. Or of course, I need to do certain of it, but it's also like I need to stretch out a bit, you know. So the more I try to understand fashion from this perspective of the victim that tries to produce DIY practice of self-defense, in a sense,
mm.
you know. I felt like the less understanding I have, the more I was trying to understand that and talk about liberation, empowerment, reclaiming the sewing machine, all these kind of things I was really trying to do, the less I understood of the dynamics of power,
mm-hmm.
of the dynamics of what do really people feel? Why is it that they just feel so great getting this Chanel thing or getting this really expensive thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt like I need to stretch out to get out of this little self-defense bubble that I had sort of painted myself
mm-hmm.
into, or, you know, or escaped into, or I don't know, like retreated into exactly, you know, in order to sort of just step out there to understand what are the dynamics going on there that also had me retreat into
mm-hmm.
this bubble, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that was why really I started writing these small manifestos from this Ralph Fronsov, who is this kind of, you know, fashion elitist, you know, supporting writer, but and using a kind of a Machiavellian sort of Nietzschean voice almost, you know, trying to rah, something, anger, some, you know, but also understanding ambition, you know, that, that certain people, you know, of course there is ambition. People want to excel often, you know, we want, often it feels good getting those, that attention, you know, that those people that just give you that, you know, wow, those are really nice looking, you know, the ego boost you when you get those nice comments and feel seen and in the attention of others in a positive way. Of course, that is totally addictive, but you know, or something. So just I'm trying to understand these dynamics better. Yeah, that was a long answer again, but yes, right. Nice. And I think, so coming back, I think a lot of my writing then tries to sort of balance also so many of these perspectives, to try to sort of not take one position. I think what often happens in academia is like you have one point to make and you really try to hammer that point in.
Yeah.
And I feel like I really need to take much more. Yes. It's a lot of different things happening there. At the same time, I think, you know, there is a central theme to my work. You know, I'm interested in agency. I'm interested in, you know, who can do what. Why is it that in fashion, especially, well, in many things, of course, in consumer economy in general and commodity, and you know, but in fashion, we become so reliant and we seek to be told by others what to wear. We feel so much safer being led by others, you know, that I want the designer to design something for me. I want to be blessed by this editor who has picked out. I can dress any way possible, but it's so judgmental. It's so fearful to do this. So if just Supreme could tell me what to wear, or Chanel or whatever, you know, just anyone tell me what to wear and put your logo on it to approve it, so I don't have to deal with it. You know, there's something about the safety that the branding and the whole fashion economy offers us. That is so addictive and so, you know, and how, of course, the fashion world is so centered around, that we often don't think about exactly what is the risks, what are the game, why isn't it that people have more agency, or is it too risky exactly to have this agency? Is it that we actually, most of us have just chosen it away because we're so hurt from our childhood that we don't, you know, we all just want to pass the day without having someone say something bad about, you know, so it's like,
I am sorry too, but in a book you were writing like that's belonging to a tribe, like earning a Chanel bag or something like this. Do you think it's also about that we want to belong somewhere, and then like that's the safest way to go to? In former times it was church, blah, 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 but we don't have this feeling of society anymore. But having something which has a name on it and more people have it, maybe that something, you know.
Right, right. Oh, of course. I mean, and, you know, people can take sociological perspectives on this, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, on a very primitive, basic level, you know, I think, we are a species that is wired to connect. You know, we're born helpless. You know, we have no possibility of surviving without connecting to mother, especially, but family or whatever, you know, to get support. We scream, we are fed, you know, we feel immediately, we get to know what is reward, what is not, what is the social dynamic here. And I think we are aware of much more subtle signals, and social cognition is so much more complex than we treat it in our everyday life. You know, yes, we put this, oh, you want to belong to a subculture, you want to belong to this group or something like that. Yes, but we also just want to have that little social relationship with people, and we're so aware of what those dynamics are that we we're taught long before we can speak when we are seen, when we're not seen, how we're seen, how we're not seen. You know, so when the child is like, look at me, you know, I can do this, look, mom, no hands, you know, that kind of, you know, that's something that is like the first thing, where is our parents' attention, you know, how do we get that in or not, you know, and then of course then we go like, oh, hi, cool friend or not, you know, here I am, you know, so we try to, you know, so of course it's like being ignored, being rejected, being, you know, that those emotions are so strong that, yes, we can discuss them through sociological models and these kind of things. It's just that, well, you know, just open up a bit of your memories and most probably they're there, you know, on a so deep emotional level. And of course, exactly, that is really those dynamics and those fears that fashion taps into. That is so much, you know, yes, I think we have too often thought of fashion and consumerism as some sort of propaganda, something that convinces us or not, or something like that. I think it's so much more primitive or deeper in us. It plays so much with our anxieties and social fears conscious of and have a... Well, I haven't encountered too much language around that in fashion. That's really where I'm trying to sort of push a bit of this. Yes. Or unpack a bit more about this.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I feel like also like you're offering ideas which I think could offer actions which could make us more confident. Like there was one little film where you say like if we would all have a sewing kit with us, like walking around the city, you know, we could help somebody if they like the how's it called, the button is broken or something. I really loved it because it's playful ideas. I think you have a lot of them.
Right. Yes.
It could be like a trick to, you know. Like,
yes. Right. And I think, I mean, that example is exactly this: that, you know, can we shift this attention? That perhaps certain kind of attention that we connect to fashion is really a hierarchical attention, like who has the coolest thing, how am I positioned socially? If you know, what would be ways of approaching fashion as a fashion designer that was trying to impose more attention of care? That or exactly, you know, how can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how would that change that garments are a bit imperfect, and we have repair kits, we have ways to connect.
Mm-hmm.
Could that encourage a much more careful, a much more caring dressed environment in a sense? And coming back to that question about putting ideas out there, I think, and it kind of ties back a bit to this kind of meandering writing and this kind of, you know, attention that is sort of simmering around. And I think, I mean, also coming back, I feel a bit, it's also a bit like role-playing, coming
mm-hmm.
back to this, that when you play these games often, you try to put hints out there all the time. I mean, especially when you lead the game as this kind of game master, and you have a group of other players. You try to continuously send out small signals that they can, or baits in a sense, you know, that they can catch. And then you hope that they will take them on, because
mm-hmm.
that is what leads the game. Is if you are leading too much as a storyteller, as a game master,
mm-hmm.
it becomes quite boring, you know. So you really want to delegate as much of the storytelling to your players as possible, and you just sort of orchestrate a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what produces a good playing environment. And I often feel that is the way I write. I try to put a lot of ideas out there and just leave them there, which is, you know, and hope that people can take them and go wherever they
yeah.
want to go with them, in a sense. As a teacher, I do a lot of similar things. I try to throw out a lot of ideas to my students and hope, perhaps someone takes them, perhaps not, you know.
Mm.
And I just can't help myself from like throwing ideas to my students. Like, what if you did this? How could you do this? Blah, 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 you know.
Yeah.
So they are sort of under a storm of ideas. And some of them, I mean, I try to balance it, but I can't
mm.
sometimes just help myself. You know, I really love this idea of bouncing ideas,
mm.
of putting ideas out there. Because it's also a way that, well, my mind works, I think.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, have you grown up? You know, what you cultivate in your head is really
yes.
what your head becomes full of. right. So that's just how
yeah.
it works. Yes.
So cool. Like, do you have some more minutes and we could play a little game?
uh-huh. Okay.
Oh, but it's like, it's only, maybe it's like a hint game.
Okay.
I felt, because I'm very much into words and word plays and... I wanted to start, but then we were like talking, and which was great. And I feel like now we can maybe slide out of it. But I say a word, and you just associate something with it.
How much am I allowed to say?
I don't know how much you want. Like one sentence.
Okay.
As you wish.
Okay.
Okay. The first word is wardrobe.
Yes. War.
Oh my gosh! I never thought of this.
Yes, it's a struggle between me and what I wear, and that is.
Yeah.
The epicenter of this struggle.
Okay.
There's a lot of struggles happening in the wardrobe. And yes.
Oh my gosh. Basic.
Bare. The lowest non-riskiness of things.
Okay. Must have.
Must have.
Yeah, like when I was a teenager, like the
yeah, of course.
Magazines always like
coercion, what others press you to have is
mm-hmm.
like must have. I mean,
you know, as a woman you have to have a black dress, like a white blouse, and blah, blah, blah.
Right. I mean,
jeans.
Yes. I mean, there's a difference between a must-have that is food,
yeah.
perhaps, or like,
mm-hmm.
sorry, but a must-have.
Yeah.
I think often what we mistake ourselves in the sense that we think that must-haves is something that I must have, but it's actually my friends that must have it on me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
if you're, okay,
we talk about
right.
Yeah, we talk about that. Yeah, that's cool. Style.
style. I mean, I'm an old art historian. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where my basic academic struggle. You know, studies of style. That means Baroque. You know, Rococo. It means something that lasts 100 years. Mm. You know, it's a so you know, so that's what I often think of style. I mean, I think another way of approaching style is thinking of character.
Mm-hmm.
That style is something that is connected to character. At the same time, I think I was very fascinated by that long ago, or before that. You know, how do you grow character? Character is something. Is that something nice to have?
Mm-hmm.
Or is character also just something that is like petrified, something that is frozen inside of you?
Mm-hmm.
So my character is something that is unchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
Do I really want to have character? You know, what if my character is impossible? What if I have a bad character?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want, you know, before, I mean, I was using character as a positive thing before,
mm-hmm.
without really thinking of a lot of people that have bad character, that they would be good if they would not have that bad character. Exactly, that, you know, take away a little
take
of that
away
bad character.
Character.
Right, exactly, you know, but we don't, yeah, but you know,
yeah.
So, sorry, that was just style character. No.
Passion, but that's maybe easy, because I heard you saying, like, like more the word compassion, or am I right?
Right, exactly.
Like,
I've been playing with that idea that you know, sort of passion is something that, exactly, this emotional thrill or something, but how is it not egocentric, but compassion, something that is with others. I think the most important thing is to highlight how passion is unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
We often think that, oh, I have a passion for fashion, as if that is some interest that I'm having that I'm really aware of. No, a passion is something that you're not in control of.
Yeah.
A passion is something that is possesses you.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is inflicted on you. You know, a passion is something that is a fire that is out of control. So, you know, I think it's just not having the focus on rationality and that we are in control. I think it's just that passion is a much more struggle, is a much more conflicting
mm-hmm.
state to be in.
Nice
one. Yeah. A passionate love affair. It's like, I'm possessed. You know,
yeah.
I cannot, my mind races, my heart races, everything is out of control.
Well,
you know,
like, I am not sure if I pronounced it right, Hall. Like, you know, these YouTube videos, like teenagers do,
Halls,
like show
yes,
Halls.
Yes, I mean, I don't, but I know it's, you know, of course, it's I mean, it is, of course, conspicuous consumption in its most weird way, because, of course, it's often, it's a fascinating thing. Often we think that if we look at the classic movie, people are competing about their desires. They're competing who is the most dressed up one. So, for example, you know, a classic scene would be this dressed up lady or something that would wear this fancy dress, and then her rival wears a similar dress or something, like, you know.
Big problem,
yeah. I don't know if that even happens, but
yeah.
I mean, it feels like this is sort of a drama around that. But that is because they're wearing the same thing at this moment, you know. And it feels like then what happens with the haul is like, I don't even wear it yet. You know, I don't even care to wear it. I just unpack it and haul it out of my bag even before I wear it, you know. So there's something about the competition happening at the state of, just at the state of purchase. We haven't even, exactly, we don't even wear the dress in order to compete. Here we just unpack things in order to compete, you know. So we're trying to move ahead. It's like, I don't have time to wear it, to show it to you. I need to just show it to you even when I'm unpacking it, you know. Which I think is even fascinating, because then you come to sort of blogging. Oh, and you don't even blog, but you know, the way you share, you share your desires, so you share things even before you have bought them. It's like, this is the stuff I want. This is the stuff I'm gonna buy.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, isn't this cool? So you haven't even come to the whole state yet, you know. The competition happens in already what I wish for. You know, it's like everybody coming with a Christmas gift and trying to compare, like, who wishes for the coolest thing for Christmas? No, but you know, so there's something about, I think it's the same competitive environment and feeling of euphoria that I got at the latest kind of coolest thing, but the whole just moves it ahead to, I've just entered my apartment, I put on my webcam and just, ah! Yeah. Oh, whatever,
it's a very funny way to make a parody of it. Okay, like high fashion.
If you come to so discuss high fashion, you come to do definitions of fashion, definitions of whatever. I love to discuss, and I think I to me, fashion is something that we wear in everyday life. It is something that is a social dynamic. I mean, I love this. I always use Susanne Pagel, a Swedish journalist, definition of fashion is to wear what everyone else has, but before everyone else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So It's just this little dynamic in everyday life of wearing the latest thing before someone else. So I often feel that what happens at the fashion school is like people look at the sort of the runways and weird fashion exhibits and things that are never really worn as if that is fashion, and they define fashion as that. It's a little bit of like an art form. You know, there was a comment long ago, and I forgot by whom, is like, haute couture relates to fashion the way that Formula One relates to car industry. I mean, mm-hmm. Nobody drives around in a Formula One car, you know, yeah. But it's part of the car industry, it's part of developing, you know, the techniques and these kind of things, you know. So similarly, haute couture, nobody wears, I mean, extremely few wear technically really what is on that catwalk, looking in those masks or whatever people are wearing, you know. Of course, certain kind of, but you know, so there's a certain kind of, it's the space industry of, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. I know if I feel like a fashion school, you know, we put too much attention on understanding what high fashion is rather than understanding what low fashion is, mm-hmm. if you want to say, or the everydayness of fashion, and mm-hmm. really what people are wearing in everyday life and how that affects them, their life experiences. Yes.
But then I have a little question, like, do you go to fashion shows? You like this catwalk thing? Yeah, didn't talk about that. Okay. Like the last one, I have like New York confidence. I felt the last days. That's a very personal one. Like there's a special confidence in the city. Am I right?
No, but there is something that I felt quite early, that there's something in the diversity that people feel, and some sort of natural belonging that is very different than I feel the dynamics, at least in a place like Sweden, or I mean, at least where I come from in Sweden, where what is sort of foreign or what is normal is something, what doesn't belong, is something that's very apparent often, mm-hmm. you know, even if people don't want to admit it, there's something that is the way landscape is laid, that certain things just stick out in ways that is not just uncomfortable or something, but it just marks itself as foreign of some mm-hmm. sort, you know, whereas here it's not. Mm-hmm. There is a certain kind of confidence that comes of just that stuff belongs, mm-hmm. which I'm just really, I mean, still trying to better understand, but it's really fascinating in that sense that this, in its extreme diversity, there's something so that everybody owns themselves in a mm-hmm. way that is so affirming and so fantastic too. In itself, you know, it's
and that's what you say after 10 years. So.
Yeah, no, right, no, but sure, you know, like, right, yeah. right. It's
okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm like, pleasure.
It was such a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
I'm rich now.
And I mean, we can continue this next time.